You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
If this is a genuine ceasefire, then of course that would be welcome. But what matters most of all is actually actions on the ground rather than just words on a piece of paper.
UK Prime Minister David Cameron attempting optimism vis-a-vis the latest ceasefire agreement in Ukraine. Daniela Peled and Robert Fox will be joining me shortly to ask if this really means an end to the fighting, as well as discussing the day's other top stories. Later in the show, we'll leaf through the Brazilian news weeklies, find out why a London art gallery is exhibiting a forgery, and look at the week's best new books. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. But ahead of all that, the latest world news with Paul Osborne.
Germany's Chancellor says there's a glimmer of hope after a deal was agreed to impose a ceasefire in Ukraine. It will come into force over the weekend after 17 hours of talks in Minsk between Angela Merkel, Francis François Hollande and the leaders of Ukraine and Russia. Under the plan, a buffer zone will be enforced and heavy weapons will be withdrawn from the front line. The French President, Mr. Hollande, said that if the deal holds, it could make a significant difference.
The global settlement will address all the issues, from the ceasefire to border control, ultimately including decentralisation, the removal of heavy weaponry, and also the re-establishment of economic relations.
The White House says the deal is a potentially significant step towards resolving the conflict, but Monocle's Joshua Yaffa, who's in Moscow, says the Russian president will claim he won several concessions from the talks.
It was never clear exactly what Putin was willing to risk, what card he was going to play at any given time, and I think that ability to keep the West off balance is what allowed Putin to emerge dominant, maybe not fully victorious, but at least to extract some tactical victories from a situation where he might overall strategically be quite weak.
After negotiating the Ukraine ceasefire, the leaders of France and Germany went to Brussels for a summit of EU leaders. They're also discussing the continuing row over the Greek bailout. The country's new Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, arrived at the talk saying he was confident a deal could be reached to restructure the terms of the rescue package. A court in Egypt has ordered the release on bail of two Al Jazeera journalists who have been in jail for more than a year. There were cheers in the courtroom when the decision was announced at the retrial of Mohamed Fahmy and Baha Mohamed. They had initially been sentenced to up to 10 years in jail for spreading false news in support of the now banned Muslim Brotherhood. The third journalist, Peter Gresta, was freed last week and deported to his native Australia. Mohamed Fahmy's fiancée, Mawa Amara, gave her reaction outside the court.
I'm very happy and I just want to say thank you, Egypt. Thank you for doing the right thing. I would like to thank my country that I love for doing the right thing. I'm very happy. I'm very happy and it's time for me and for Mohammed to be relaxed.
Al-Qaeda-linked fighters in Yemen say they have seized control of a large army base in the south of the country. They've claimed to be holding a large number of soldiers hostage at the base in Shabwa province. The dawn attack comes as the UN warns Yemen is on the brink of civil war, following the move by Houthi militias to seize control of the capital, Sana'a. Aid workers are warning of a worsening food crisis in South Sudan. Fighting continues between government forces and rebels, despite the latest ceasefire deal being signed just a week ago. It's estimated up to a fifth of the country's population, some 2.5 million people, now need food aid. Vilma Tyler is from UNICEF.
If nothing happens, there's no intervention right now, they can tip over. And then we can see potentially children at risk of dying. We do not wait till the famine is declared, because when the famine is declared, it's too late. Children have already died. We intervene to ensure that we do not reach that stage.
The Red Cross says its staff working to control Ebola in Guinea are being attacked 10 times a month on average. In the most recent incident, two volunteers were beaten as they tried to arrange the safe burial of an Ebola victim. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House, coming up for 1806 in London, which will be, oh, I don't know, 1506 in Buenos Aires. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and contributor to Haaretz, among others, and Robert Fox, defence editor of the Evening Standard here in London. Welcome both. We will start tonight in Minsk, where a peace agreement concluded after 16 hours of negotiations between Messrs Putin, Poroshenko, Lukashenko, Merkel and Hollande, has so far failed to flood the streets and town squares of Russia and Ukraine with scenes reminiscent of VE Day. It's almost as if people suspect Moscow of negotiating in bad faith. Daniela, I'll ask you first. Vladimir Putin, as I understand it, is promising to withdraw Russian heavy weaponry that he still claims was never there in the first place. How seriously should we be taking any of this?
Well, we can take it seriously, I guess, but we shouldn't have very serious expectations, if that doesn't seem contradictory. I mean, it's quite interesting. The whole agreement has been devised without ever really acknowledging that the Russians were there, have been there, might be there, or might have anything to do with it. There's a talk of withdrawal of foreign troops and foreign mercenaries without really mentioning
They want to be very clear about getting all those Brazilians and Cook Islanders out of Ukraine.
Quite right. And it's also not really clear how we're going to be sure that these foreign military elements have left. In any case, I mean, the whole verification of this ceasefire is up in the air. The whole agreement seems, on initial reading, full of holes. I mean, full of contradictions and full of get-out clauses. But I mean, I think it's not unreasonable to imagine that Putin is enjoying his sort of nice evening cigar and sitting back thinking good day's work, really.
Well, I rather suspect myself that Putin has spent most of the last year or so laughing himself to sleep. Robert, is there anything here that wasn't in the previous Minsk agreement last September?
I think there's quite a bit more. And as we've said, there's quite a bit that really hasn't been decided yet. The ceasefire comes in at 0001 on the 15th of February. There'll be a hell of a lot of fighting between now and then, particularly over Debaltseve, which we must talk about. Debaltseve is symbolic, but really very practically important. Poroshenko's lost a lot more territory already in conceding this. While there is, to take up Daniela's point of contradiction, the frontiers of Ukraine seem to be guaranteed, but Putin really wants guarantees about the autonomous regions and how much autonomy they can have, and also a negotiation on the nature of Ukraine itself, which he wants to be more of a loose federation. It's continued page 94. This will go on. I think it has absolutely no chance of succeeding. I think it's in the outre in the way that the Minsk September agreement was, because for one simple reason, if you look at a map, Russia hasn't achieved its objectives, its culminating point of the offensive, which began at the beginning of January this year.
Daniela, on that point, though, isn't that what has been the point all along, that basically there is a limit which we may have reached as to what anybody can do to stop Russia doing as it pleases in the immediate vicinity of Russia?
Yeah, I mean, what this certainly has done is bought Putin some time to think about his next move. And I'm not sure that I agree that there's a final objective here. I mean, my feeling over the last year more has been that really Russia is feeling its way, seeing how far we can go, what people will tolerate here, and being tactical rather than strategic in that sense. Certainly, the deadline for an agreement, a constitutional agreement and local elections and so on at the end of this year seems really fantasy. And the best thing can say for now is that after the next few days of immense violence, I imagine. I really wouldn't want to be a civilian on the front line the next until the ceasefire comes in. Then there might be a period of calm, you know, a period where there is less fighting there. And I mean, that's kind of the best we can hope for at the moment. Anything, and I think we're deluding ourselves if we think this is anything like an actual deal, an actual agreement that will last.
Robert, it is difficult to know and has been, as Daniela points out, over the last month, year or so now, where Putin exactly does think he's going with this. But is it tolerable, I guess, from Ukraine's point of view, that there would be a permanent sort of, I guess the obvious analogy is Republika Srpska in Bosnia, that there would be this sort of Republika Rossiya in eastern Ukraine? Is that something that Ukraine might just have to learn to live with?
Well, that's what Putin really hopes for. I rather disagree about Putin again. I think Putin really believes in what he's saying. And I think Putin really is like Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's, who wasn't a phony, you may remember, because she was really phony about the things she was phony about.
Maybe the first time anybody's ever compared the two. Congratulations.
Yeah, this is the most interesting stuff about people who really do understand about Putin land. Fascinating discussion on another channel, the BBC, this morning between Edward Lucas of The Economist, who's an extremely accomplished Russian observer, and Professor Christopher Clark, Regius Professor of History at Cambridge, who had a stunning book on the opening of the First World War called The Sleepwalkers. Now, Mr. Sunshine was Professor Clark. Mr. Rain was very much Edward. And in my opinion, Edward got so much better of the argument because he said it's no use bringing historical analogy. Parallel lines, as they don't in geometry and history, never converge. This is not about 1938. It's not about 1914. It's about a very interesting view of the world that Putin has. And we are still seeing it through a triumphalist, post-Cold War Occidentalist lens. He really does think, and this now is plain from everything he is saying and doing, that he is threatened by NATO. And he cites all kinds of things. We say, oh, no, these are really safety measures, things from anti-ballistic missile defense systems being put in Poland and the Czech Republic. He is going on. And I think that on the ground, the question we have to ask is it just sufficient to answer your question that he is going to rest on his laurels for the time being for this campaign with having Luhansk and Donetsk? If that is it, then he's got to take, by the way, Debaltseve in the next 2 days, because that is the rail link, it's the road link, and it's also the gas link. There are two or three other towns of a similar nature, and they are further to the north. The question that I find astonishing that people are not asking is, if you look at the map, it doesn't make sense to have that unless you take out Kharkiv as well. Is he really trying to annex all the land east of the Dnieper River? And I think historically, for that is a big heartland and it's a sacred heartland for Russia. I am absolutely sure that that is what, if he's not aiming for it, a lot of his close advisors are. There are two of the iconic battle sites for the psyche of Russia through its history are there. Poltava, 1709, Peter the Great's defeat of Charles XII of Sweden, and Kharkov, which really was the decisive battle which rolled back the Wehrmacht, the Teutonic Knights of the time, as it were, in the Second World War. I just do not see this thing sticking where it is now. I am very sceptical.
Daniela, this is a thought, or a variation of that thought has occurred to me at least at various points over the last year. Are we genuinely failing, and by we I mean the West, is there a genuine failure of imagination to see the world as Russia sees it?
Well, I think that's a general issue. We seeing the world as from a very different perspective, and that's why democracies have a bit of a problem here with a unified response, and more autocratic regimes find it easier to sort of draw a straight line and have a straight narrative. The thing is that Russia is selling its own story to its own people very, very well, very, very efficiently. There's an incredible network of propaganda. I mean, we see Russia today. Russia today is just one tiny cog in what's going on. And so I think I'm not entirely sure about Robert's rather apocalyptic view on this. I think that Putin can sell to his own people whatever he wants right now, to go as far or to retreat, not completely. I mean, what we have is the best scenario now. The best scenario is a sort of frozen conflict.
Akin to Georgia, say.
Well, akin to Georgia. The thing is that it's going to be a lot more expensive than Georgia or Transnistria, and that's the problem. That's the problem for Russia. But I mean, look, Crimea was lost 5 minutes into this whole...
And it's lost.
Yeah. I mean, that was it. You know, we knew, it was very clear, that was it, not coming back. And so I think the best case scenario for what's going on in the south and east of Ukraine is, no, certainly, it's not going to come back to the status quo where we were a year ago.
Robert, looking at it from the point of view of those democracies trying and failing to understand Russia, is this, from the point of view of Merkel and Hollande, who were obviously spearheading these peace agreements, I guess, on behalf of the West, is this a result for them, or were they just trying because it was better than not trying?
I think it's the latter, because the body language certainly said that. There were no handshakes. There was no triumphalism.
There was a snapped pencil
at the beginning. But also at the end, it's very interesting. And a very tired Merkel had to go off to Brussels to deal with the Greeks. And that's another weapon in the arsenal of Mr. Putin. And he's playing it very skillfully, actually. I think they must be very worried. But I'm quite interested in what the successive Nordic Secretaries General of NATO have been saying. They're very interesting, Angus Fogh Rasmussen and now Jens Stoltenberg. They say NATO, allegedly, according to Mr. Cameron, is pledged to spending 2% of GDP on defence and security issues. We know from briefings in the UK government, from ministers through to senior officials, they have no intention of doing that in the UK. Nor anywhere else, I think, very much in the European part of the NATO alliance. Look upon this. Since 2007, Russia has increased its annual expenditure on defence by over 30%. They are building new nuclear weapons and they're moving them forward. They are going to introduce next year a Generation 5 fighter, the T-50, the PAK, as it's so called, with a little bit of Indian money in it. But actually, in air-to-air combat, there is nothing to rival it in the West. And we've had these incursions, which we first of all treat as a joke, ha-ha, Russian submarines, are they, or is it a whale, off Sweden? And then the Brits don't have the aircraft to see a Russian submarine penetrating Scottish coastal waters, call in the French, and it isn't one submarine, but two. And we have the Bears coming over, and there have been no fewer than 140 incursions in the past 8 months of these long-range bombers coming in, coming to have a look and turning their transponders off and nearly caused two very serious air accidents with Swedish civilian aircraft. Sorry, I won't bore you to death. Something is going on. And it's something to which NATO is offering from the regional neighbours, and it is a European question, as Mr. Obama never ceases to remind us, there is no collective response.
Just finally on this, then, Daniela, is there any cause for optimism here at all, really? I mean, I guess the most optimistic assessment you could be is that maybe Putin has got more or less what he wants and he is now trying to draw a line under this. But is that, am I being just Pollyanna-ish at this point?
I don't think there's any line being drawn anywhere right now. I mean, it's just a question of time, you know. I mean, as Robert says, there are other things going on in Europe. You know, Merkel, Angela Merkel can go back and deal with Greece now. The US has got other things on its schedule, including the Iran talks, all kinds of issues that if things quieten down a bit, I think the focus will be off and Putin will have a space where he can work out what to do next. I mean, I think really the best thing that we can hope this time is it's more successful than last September, which really isn't asking a lot.
You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Peled and Robert Fox. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll be asking why so many African migrants continue to run the terrible risks of the Mediterranean crossing, and we'll consider Pyongyang's latest charm offensive.
As the day draws down in Europe and the next morning begins in Asia, the Monocle Daily is on hand to bring you up to speed with a one-hour programme packed with news, business and the best culture and design stories from around the world. Our presenting team in London are joined by guests in Monocle's New York and Toronto studios.
There's lots that the US and the international community can do, but it's enfeebled by its diplomatic and political shortcomings.
And as the sun rises from Tokyo to Sydney, we'll take a look at some of the more interesting front pages landing on doorsteps across the region.
The authority of the Chinese Communist Party has been challenged on its doorstep in Hong Kong, and they do not like it.
That's the Monocle Daily, every weekday at 2200 hours London time, in association with UBS.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24, 21 minutes past the hour. Still with me are Daniela Pellad from the Institute of War and Peace reporting, Robert Fox from the Evening Standard. Earlier this week, more than 300 people drowned when their improvised convoy of dinghies sank somewhere between Libya and their hoped-for sanctuary in Europe. Horrific though this disaster was, it was far from unusual. The UNHCR estimates that 3,500 people drowned undertaking the same journey last year, around 10 a day, and those are, of course, just the ones we know about. Robert, Italy was running quite a large-scale operation last year, Mare Nostrum. It's been replaced by a smaller EU one, Operation Triton. Why, if the EU has stepped up in replacing Italy, has it become a smaller thing rather than a bigger one?
In a word, cynicism. You heard what David Cameron said about this, that he wasn't going to contribute to the patrols of Triton, but provide some backup security agencies. It's such a colossal problem that people, I think, are displacing and avoiding it for as long as they possibly can.
Because the numbers are extraordinary. 200,000 people rescued by Mare Nostrum. And again, those are just the ones we know about.
Yes, exactly. But all the figures are completely unreliable. You can start out from that.
But they are colossal.
They are colossal. To mention the sainted BBC, they were doing a report on this, and every figure they came up with, I spend a lot of time in Italy. I've just been in Italy again. I've been with the interior minister or ministry authorities, and they've been very, very frank about this. They are absolutely desperate. They rescued 141,000 last year by their books. That is by the Italian Navy and Coast Guard books. They know that they lost trying to rescue 3,000 alone last year. And it is the old maxim that for every one that you can identify, almost there are two in the shadows. And they're coming from really two main sources, the elbow or the armpit of the Mediterranean around Mersin, the port of Mersin in Turkey, and also from the Maghreb, but principally Libya because of the anarchy there. And the provenance is very, very mixed indeed. It isn't just people coming from the fights in Syria and in Iraq. It's also sub-Saharan Africa. It's Somalia. No doubt Yemen will be giving it a push. And it's still, you're getting a lot of Afghans. The British response, I think, is very interesting because I've heard this now for years. Oh, if only we could deter them by telling them how horrific it is, by just abandoning them. This is a self-conscious policy by the British Interior Ministry authorities, because if we don't rescue them, that will deter them. In 48 years of journalism, and a great deal of that spent in the Mediterranean in Italy, I see no empirical evidence whatsoever that that is true.
That's the difficulty, though, or a difficulty of this, though, isn't it, Daniela, that you end up in a position where European navies are serving as accomplices to people smugglers. Is this just a thing? I mean, is there an argument, and I myself don't think there is, but is there an argument for a harder line? As Robert says, decades of trying that and not trying it haven't stopped the people coming.
Well, I think the harder line, by any reasonable terms, would be what to do with these people after we've saved them, rather than just leaving them to drown in the sea. I mean, it reflects an enormous failure, a Europe-wide failure of what to do with asylum seekers and economic migrants. I mean, countries such as Italy complain that they are unfairly put on the front line, as it is, of absorbing and dealing with this influx of people. There doesn't seem to be a strategy across Europe where there can be any sort of fair sharing of the burden. But yeah, I agree. I mean, the idea of not rescuing people, not stepping up those efforts, is it intended to appear as a deterrent? But I think if you are willing to get into some sort of shaky, unseaworthy craft and try and make it to Europe, I think you're pretty desperate anyway.
Finally, tonight then, in especially exciting news for fans of old-school socialist realist sloganeering, North Korea has celebrated the 70th anniversary of its foundation by issuing more than 300 new slogans. Among the efforts of Pyongyang's finest copywriters are such exhortations as "Make fruits rain down," "Create a socialist fairyland," "Fertilizer means rice and socialism," which may have lost something in translation, and "Let us turn ours into a country of mushrooms by making mushroom cultivation scientific, intensive, and industrialised." There is, of course, the old joke about mushrooms. It does suggest that somebody might have a sense of humour. Daniel, are these... I mean, we are in the midst of a general election campaign here. Are these really any more or less idiotic than such slogans as "We are the party of the many, let's stay on the road to a stronger economy and change that works for you"?
I think the major difference is how sarcastic a tone one pronounces it in. I mean... You know, these. I'm not au fait with Korean, but perhaps there is. They've got this longevity of, keep calm and carry on, but involving mushrooms.
Robert, there is, of course, an awful lot of included among the 300 cheerful exhortations to work hard. There's an awful lot of that North Korean chest prodding. My particular favourite being, should the enemy dare to invade our country, annihilate them to the last man so that none of them will survive to sign the instrument of surrender. Is there... I never know quite whether it's the right thing to do to laugh at North Korea. It is obviously incredibly funny at one level, but North Korea is an actual place. Should we take this stuff seriously?
It's called the Borax syndrome, isn't it? I find it very difficult because a great friend of mine, the Washington Post, Blaine Harden, wrote the story of the escapee who had to turn himself into a psychopath to get out, more or less, a very famous account. I think it's a very frightening place, and I think attempts to patronise it, including Sony Pictures, is absolutely nonsensical. I don't think you want to have to be pompous about it, but it is very akin to the great works of genius of George Orwell and Franz Kafka, 1984, and the trial.
Christopher Hitchens once wrote that it was as if the founders of North Korea read 1984 and thought, great idea, let's make it work.
And there was a great writer too, and I say that not sarcastically, another great friend. And I think it is right, and I think you have to see them for what they are, because they seem clownish. I think that's what you're getting at. But the clowning can turn to being very sinister when you're suddenly shooting up literally routine patrols off the coast and sinking ships for no very good reason. And I think that this is what worries their principal sponsor, China, most, is the sheer unpredictability of all this. They just could do something really daft because they have the kit to do it now, as we know.
Daniela, what do you think? Because people laugh at North Korea a lot. They laugh at the sort of ridiculous photos of Kim Jong-un, you know, pointing at things. There are entire blogs dedicated to pictures of Kim Jong-un pointing at things. But I'm never quite sure whether it is the appropriate or correct response, or even, in fact, whether it's something they're actually trying to entice themselves. The idea that if we are laughing at them, we're not taking them as seriously as we should.
I don't know. I think people take it seriously. I think people laugh because it seems so unknowable and also because they're afraid. I mean, amongst the 300-odd slogans, and I've read analyses, people trying to pick through them, seeing what does this indicate in terms of policy? Is there a change in terms of agriculture, in terms of defence? Because there is so much that seems unpredictable and there's so much that is unknowable about North Korea. I think by laughing at it, people are trying to make it a bit more manageable. But I don't think anyone takes it any less seriously for that.
Well, with that, we shall have to turn out in the general offensive to hasten the final victory of the revolutionary spirit and leave it there. Daniela Pellid and Robert Fox, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll review the Brazilian news weeklies, we'll look at the best new books, and we'll wonder what the difference really is between an old master and an extremely convincing forgery. But before we get started on all that, Paul Osborne has the headlines.
Germany's Chancellor has said there is a glimmer of hope after a deal was agreed to impose a ceasefire in Ukraine. It's due to come into force over the weekend and follows 17 hours of talks in Minsk between Angela Merkel, the French President François Hollande, and the leaders of Ukraine and Russia. Under the plan, a buffer zone is due to be enforced and heavy weapons could be withdrawn from the front line. The leaders of France and Germany then went to Brussels, where a summit of EU leaders has been taking place. They're discussing the continuing row over the Greek bailout. The country's new Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, arrived at the talk saying he was confident a deal could be reached. A court in Egypt has ordered the release on bail of two Al Jazeera journalists who have been in jail for more than a year. There were cheers in the courtroom when the decision was announced at the retrial of Mohamed Fahmy and Baha Mohamed, who had initially been sentenced to up to 10 years in jail. And Al-Qaeda-linked fighters in Yemen say they've seized control of a large army base in the south of the country. They've claimed to be holding a large number of soldiers hostage at the base in Shabwa province. That attack came as the UN warned that Yemen is now on the brink of civil war. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. Welcome back to Midori House. You're live on Monocle 24. It is 21:31 in Moscow, which makes it 18:31 here in London, 16:31 in Rio de Janeiro. We're going to continue now with a roundup of what the Brazilian news weeklies have been saying this week. Joining me to help me with this, because, you know, I don't speak Brazilian very well, and yes, I know. Anyway, you knew what I was doing there. Is one of our resident Brazilians, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Welcome to Midori House. What do we have? Well, I'm looking at the front pages, and as discussed, I don't read a lot of Brazilian. I can see on the front, though, of Carta Capital, that is a heck of a depressing Carnival cover story.
Very depressing. You would imagine that in Carnival week we would have very positive stories, but, you know...
Well, you know, he's got the funny hat on and there are streamers, but this is very much the morning after photo.
I think he might be even a bit drunk, I would say. Well, so basically, besides this picture that you just described, it's written, Brazil, Wednesday Ashes. You know, of course, Wednesday Ashes is the last day of Carnival. And basically, Carta Capital is like a smaller left-of-center title. So they have series of essays with economists describing how serious is the crisis in Brazil, not only economically, but, you know, we don't have water in the main city of São Paulo. You know, there's corruption at Petrobras, our national oil company. So it is pretty heavy reading. So actually, I chose something a little bit lighter that the culture editor of Carta Capital actually chose. He said, even though with all this crisis happening in Brazil, everybody was paying attention in someone, and her name is Bond, Danny Bond, actually. It's a woman.
See,
I have
what
to say.
You did there. and why is everyone paying attention to her?
Well, basically, they're describing there's a new miniseries on TV by Fernando Meirelles, which is the director of City of God, the most iconic Brazilian film of all time. And Danny Bond, which is performed by actress Paola Oliveira, she's playing a high-class prostitute that is hired by a couple who wants to spice things up in bed, actually. So it's quite an avant-garde series, I have to say. And I've watched it myself, and it was very good. And there's a lot of nudity. And Paola Oliveira is naked. She does give a very good performance. But, you know, she was naked, and all Brazilians were talking about that. But I have to say, they were all very tasteful scenes, I have to say.
is this a step up from our sort of slightly stereotyped idea of South American television drama, which tends to be lots of women with too much makeup on and enormous hair throwing crockery at each other while the walls wobble in the background?
Yeah, first of all, there was no makeup. Actually, there was a lot of the scenes, they were in a waterfall in Brasilia, which is where that kind of miniseries was set. And there was kind of a corruption background as well. And in the end, the high-class prostitute, Danny Bone, she end up with the wife, so they have a lesbian affair as well. Very good scenes, I have to say.
Okay, so that's in Carta Capital. Is there less depressing fare available elsewhere? Say, in, well, a poker has a bright orange. Is that how I'm pronouncing it?
Epoca.
Okay, it's a bright orange
That's
color.
That's happy, no? It looks happy, the cover.
Well, it looks happy until you look at the three extremely unhappy-looking men whose head and shoulders at the bottom, and they look like they've just arrived on your doorstep to repossess your television.
Oh, wow.
Who are they?
Well, basically, it's kind of a positive story. They're saying they are the men that are changing Brazil, because Brazil's currently, of course, they are the judges and prosecutors of the Operação Lava Jato, or the Operation Car Wash, which is the name given to the investigation at Petrobras. So basically, Epoca saying that there's some sort of revolution against corruption in Brazil. And those are the men who are kind of helping. I can name them. Carlos Fernando, Sérgio Moro, and Delton Dallagnol. And also, there's another interesting thing about this cover, because, well, I'm not sure if it's going to be funny for our foreign listeners, but they have like three little stories on the top of the magazine. And one, it says, it looks like a joke, that's a ready joke, and that's not a joke. So basically, I'll tell you very briefly. The first one that looks like a joke, basically they're describing the rich state of a country that is fighting against drought. That's a little game of words, because okay. São Paulo, of course, is the richest city in Brazil, and, you know, we don't know how to fight the drought, because, you know, it's a terrible crisis. They're actually talking about California in the US, which famously, you know, I think they had a drought a few years ago. I'm not sure myself, but so just saying that São Paulo should, you know, use California as an example in a way. And the one in the middle, the joke one, is that a former executive from Petrobras, the national oil company, he had a car wash actually himself. He was the owner of one, but he had to sell because, you know, he's in trouble now.
So just on this Petrobras scandal, which we have covered a few times on various channels, is this becoming a big, big story in Brazil? I get the impression from this distance that it's something that's focusing years, if not decades, of widespread pent-up resentment of corruption that everybody knew about but had never been flushed into the open before.
Absolutely. You open like the box of Pandora, you know? So actually, if we can move on to the next magazine, actually. Again, more news about Petrobras. First of all, let's describe the magazine. It's Veja. I think we've mentioned here before, it's the best-selling Brazilian weekly. Very right-wing for my taste. But again, they have a cover actually talking about the Workers' Party celebrated 35 years of its existence this week. And they have a cover kind of mocking this celebration, because you see the red candle with the red star, the symbol of the party, of course. But then there's a smoke sign, $200 million, you know, kind of air.
That is written in the smoke above a flame which is very conspicuously extinguished.
So I can tell you why this price is there. Basically, that's the money the Workers' Party received from Petrobras using illegal money transfers. I mean, I always say this is the accusation. I'm not sure if that's real. But, you know, so this really damaged the party at the same week that they're celebrating 35 years. So, you know, Lula and Dilma, Lula, former mm-hmm. Brazilian president, he was with Dilma, they had a cake. But to be honest, it was not such a good celebration. And there was another interesting, one of my favorite parts of Veja is called the Yellow Pages, where they choose like a character in the week and they do like a lengthy interview with them. But this week they had a man that I'm not a fan. His name is Eduardo Cunha. He's our new, the president of our parliament, basically.
Okay, and what's he done to upset you?
Well, he's first of all, he's from the centrist party PMDB. He's an evangelical, nothing against that, but he's very conservative. Actually, he was the one who created the day of straight pride in Brazil. Nothing against straight, but you can see it. I mean, if he has to create this sort of day, because he said it was a reaction against the numerous gay prides around the country.
I'm getting the idea. Does he say anything especially or noteworthily silly in this interview?
Well, I think because, you know, it's Veja, you know, it's very serious. He didn't say anything. He just said things about abortion. We have very severe laws against abortion in Brazil. And he said, while he's the president of the parliament, he will not move the law. I mean, even though a lot of people are asking for changes in the law to become slightly more liberal and keep up, you know, with the times, he said no.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much for joining us with that wrap-up of the Brazilian Weeklies. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
What do you need to build a better city? Tech-savvy urban app builders, hipsters, will take a neglected hood and fill it with quality coffee stores and too many beards. A mayor who's a hard hitter and crack-free, or perhaps some oddballs to liven things up and keep the world a little less well-behaved. On our show, The Urbanist, we've met them all, and many more extraordinary and ordinary people besides, who form the chorus for a good city show.
If all we build is concrete and glass boxes with nothing really cool in between them, it's not as interesting or sustainable or valid a place to live as we're used to. So we got to get back to that thinking.
This one-hour program looks at all the key urban debates, from density to smart cities, but it's not a talking shop for those who think they know best. The urbanist makes the city human, sees the quirks and contradictions that turn a collection of buildings into a place where people actually want to live. Join us each week on the only show about the cities we live in. It's hosted by me, Andrew Tuck, and it premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours. Join us.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse, and eminently digestible world of food, drink, and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month, a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
. 1841 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, nobody who has spent any time in China over the last couple of decades needs to be told that the country takes a somewhat relaxed view of copyright norms. Chinese bootleggers counterfeit everything from DVDs to handbags to watches to entire shop franchises and landmark buildings. One village in China's south, the almost certainly mispronounced Dafen, specializes in what might be charitably termed replicas of famous paintings. Conceptual artist Doug Fishbone has hung one of these in a London gallery and is inviting all comers to see if they can spot it. And Doug joins me now. Doug, your exhibition at the Dulwich Picture Gallery, it's called Made in China. Why, basically?
Well, it was in fact made in China. The entire process of sourcing the replica and having it produced, it was all done through China and all done through the internet, actually. So it was quite a contemporary experience.
So is it as simple as going to the website, emailing these people saying, I want a replica of painting X, mm-hmm. what'll it cost?
Absolutely.
And how long does it take and how quickly can they run you up a masterpiece?
Well, there is a range. You know, I worked with the gallery. We decided which paintings we thought would be interesting to replicate. And I sent the image to a number of different ones. And there was a wide range of prices and times and that sort of thing. So it takes, you know, it's a whole range. But it took, I think, about 4 weeks once the order was made. And our replica turned up and it was fantastic.
And without obviously giving anything away, mm-hmm. because a big part of the game is for people to try and spot the replica among
sure.
There's 270 other paintings.
Yeah, that's right.
So it would need to be a heck of a lucky guess.
Yeah.
How good is it? Were you surprised by how good the quality was?
I was. I think it's identifiable for sure, especially if you're familiar with painting from that general era. But I think it's good enough to trick people. And I think that is what I'm interested in looking at, all the other circumstances that go into experiencing a piece of art in a kind of an institutional setting. You know, the gravitas of the gallery, the lighting, the beautiful frame, all this type of thing. When that's added, or rather when the replica is inserted into that whole broader thing, I think it becomes much trickier. We are going to show the replica next to its original after the piece is revealed to the public. So at that point, I think it's going to be quite evident that it's a replica.
Because that is what one of the questions this exhibition asks, I guess, is how much is our enjoyment or appreciation of a piece of art informed by the fact that we know
sure.
that this is the original? Just this past weekend, I happened to be at the Mauritius in The Hague,
mm-hmm.
Which has many great treasures in it, but it has, you know, a couple of original Vermeers, including
sure.
A Girl with a Pearl Earring and the sort of the view of Delft, and they're lovely pictures. But I was thinking exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
you know, I probably...
You can probably get all of those in China.
Yeah, but
I know a guy.
Just say, how much yeah. am I being, I guess, seduced by the fact that this is hanging in this venerated gallery and I know this is the real thing?
It's very hard to know because we are able to gauge people's responses at the Delitzsch Gallery because we have two iPads where people are asked to log their guess for which one they think is the replica. And so far, majority of people are not identifying it. And that also applies to some expert art critics who came down on the press launch.
Is there at least a noticeable minority guessing it over and above what would happen if people were just taking a 1 in 270 guess?
You know, I haven't actually broken that down. So you've called me on a statistical thing I need to check. But because we're able to gauge it in real time. But I was just saying, oh, you know, how many people got it? And they said 8 out of 30 or whatever it was on the first tally. So, okay. But no, I think there are some others that are cropping up as likely suspects. And that's the interesting thing, because if you look at various paintings in the collection, some that might have a more perhaps expressive brushwork or something with the varnish or the tones, there are some that are good suspect candidates, and a few of those are recurring.
I guess as well, does having, knowing there's one dodgy one in there, are you noticing it is making people behave differently than they usually might at an art gallery? Have you lured people into looking at the
art more
closely?
I think we haven't. You know, I was actually very surprised and thankful for sure that the gallery was willing to do this, because it's certainly a risky project for an eminent gallery like the Dulwich. And I think they rose to the challenge very beautifully. And I think their interest in it was that it might bring in people who are not familiar with the collection or people who want to come in and re-examine the collection from that kind of vantage point. So people are getting up close to the paintings and looking with great, you know, with furrowed brows and all that sort of thing. I think I'm hoping that people will take more time with the collection. Because it's a magnificent collection, and because it's hung enfilade, you know, several levels of paintings on the wall, there's a great deal of visual information in the gallery. So some people might just come in and do a broad sweep of the gallery. But this is asking people to get in and really take a closer look. But what I like to think is that it's making the entire collection open to suspicion, and that makes it much more a subject of scrutiny.
Is there a point here as well about the value of art? Because what we have seen, especially over the last few years, you know, completely fantastic sums of money paid for art, both old
and new
and modern. Whereas, is it a noticeably worse work of art if you just you know PayPal somebody 120 quid or so in China to knock you up something near enough?
You know, I think it's a good question. I think I would think that auction houses, if we tried to get dodgy and pass this on, would be able to spot it. But there are many people who engage in fraud in the art world. You know, we're actually dealing with a replica rather than a forgery. And I think that's an important distinction because we're not out to, delude or, you know, mislead fundamentally.
Which is the point at which the police turn up.
Yes. And or dodgy people with guns of another stripe. So we're not trying to do anything commercial. But there's a tremendous amount of activity like that. I mean, every week there's a new story about some kind of forgery ring being busted, or things like in New York recently, Noedler Gallery being busted for tremendous multi-million-dollar frauds.
Okay, and just finally then, remind us once more where it is and until when it is?
Well, the show is taking place in the Dulwich Picture Gallery in Dulwich, which I recommend everyone attend for my show, certainly, but just for the collection itself, because it's magnificent. And it's going to be on till April 28th when we reveal to the public which one is the forgery. I just said forgery, the replica. So I'm being confused myself. It's such. And then it will be on view, the replica will be on view next to its original for another few months. So I think that will be quite exciting because people who may not have been able to identify it, then seeing it outside of its frame next to the original back in its frame will think, how could I ever not have seen that?
Just final question, which does occur to me, and if you could answer relatively briefly if possible, because the clock is against us. The replica you have hung up, by dint of having been part of an art exhibition, is it now in and of itself a work of art more valuable than whatever it was you paid for it?
I hope, because we only paid about $100 for it. So I'm hoping my name sticking it on it will crank up the value, but that's not for me to decide.
Doug Fishbone, thank you very much for joining us. That is, again, it's at the Dulwich Picture Gallery here in London. You're listening to the Midori House, rather, on Monocle 24. We'll be continuing shortly with our weekly book review, but in homage to that previous discussion, although this was very much our producer Marcus Hippie's choice and not mine, this is To Power With, and you'll see what we've done here, China in Your Hand.
It was a theme she had on a scheme he had, told in a foreign land. Yeah, yeah.
To Power With, China in Your Hand. It was dreadful in 1987. The decades have not improved it. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's time now for our daily arts review. Today we are discussing books with Alex Starrett, the arts editor at Newsweek. Thanks for joining us. Two biographies we're discussing today. The first, Jeremy Thorpe by Michael Block. Now, he has obviously an eventful story to work with here. For non-British listeners, I was wondering if you give us a brief précis of the life and works of Jeremy Thorpe.
Sure. Well, the thing about Jeremy Thorpe is all one major incident. He was the leader of the Liberal Party, and sometime, I think, in the early 1970s, he was tried for the attempted assassination of a former lover, a man who'd been blackmailing him. And the real juicy detail was that the attempted assassination was done so amateurishly that the former lover was not murdered, but the former lover's dog was, a Great Dane called Rinka, after whom the scandal was named Rinkagate.
I say this as a foreigner here who has lived in this country now for 25 years, etc., 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 and is extremely fond of it. But it is one of those stories that it is unimaginable happening in any other country but this. It is a definitively British scandal in so many respects. As you say, it's a thing everybody knows about Jeremy Thorpe. How much of the book does Block focus on that?
It's obviously the climax of the book. Jeremy Thorpe's life after the trial are dealt with in about six pages, I think. So what makes it interesting though is he starts from this premise that Thorpe was always trying to get himself into trouble so that he could get himself out. That he had a real life tragic flaw, in the sense that he was a man of great gifts, great intellect, great ability to charm people. I mean, he was also of the establishment completely, was the leader of the Liberal Party, but had this part of himself that always wanted to get himself very, very close to danger, or actually in danger.
It's not that uncommon among holders of high political office, though. It does seem to be a recurring personality type. You see it not just in Britain, but in politicians all over the world, where you just think, how or why would someone in that position do something so stupid? But does he suggest that that's also part of the thing that gets Jeremy Thorpe, or indeed anyone else, into that position?
I think so. I think that what he seems to suggest, and I should say right at the start, that he fails to capture the man Jeremy Thorpe. I mean, he eludes his biographer in this book, but he does imply that part of the fun of politics for Thorpe is the constant role-playing. Thorpe himself is a great mimic, could have been an actor, and that role-playing was heightened by playing a completely different role at the same time. So on the one hand, incredibly respectable, on the other hand, the opposite.
You say he fails to capture the man Jeremy Thorpe, though. What is it you think he's missed?
Well, he keeps asserting things like Jeremy Thorpe was incredibly funny, Jeremy Thorpe's incredibly charming, he tells such good anecdotes, none of which he manages to convey on the page. I mean, I appreciate that's a hard thing to do. Charm is a very hard thing to capture. But nonetheless, you come away with it with a very comprehensive record of Jeremy Thorpe's political achievements and a very, I suppose, concrete sense of what precisely is known and what precisely is not known. But you never get the sense of what it would be like to meet Jeremy Thorpe, what his personality was.
Okay, well, we should move along to the second biography you want to talk about. This is the paperback edition is out this year. This is Barry Miles' study of William Burroughs. Does he do better? Because obviously with someone like William Burroughs, you have an immense body of work, which has been discussed and analysed and critiqued ad infinitum, and quite rightly, because it's an important body of work. But do we get a sense of William Burroughs the man from this book?
Yes, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, where Bloch amasses all these facts about Thorpe, Barry Miles seems to, I think he knew Burroughs quite well. And by, I would say, 100 pages in, you feel like you've known the man your whole life.
But he manages to make that, because that can go both ways. If a biographer knows, or even worse, was friendly with the subject. But it works for him in this case.
It does. It works extremely well. And I think it's partly because, partly it's just luck in the fact that Burroughs has left such an intensely detailed record of his own life. And so you get his voice through his own writing all the time. You also have Burroughs being surrounded by lots of articulate people like Allen Ginsberg or Jack Kerouac or whoever, who are very good at describing what Burroughs is like. So to some degree, that's the material. But yes, he captures the essence, I think.
Do we end up learning all that much about William Burroughs that we didn't previously know?
Perhaps not, but it's remarkable just for its intensity, the intensity of his life, which is a thing that you probably have to read all in one go to really get your head around. Just because, I mean, lots of artists and writers and whatnot have lived kind of rackety lives with a bit of drunkenness, then they get on the smack and come off it again or whatever. But Burroughs' life is so astonishing that, for example, I've just read this incident where he has to steal a first edition Moliere from the library of a man whose wife is divorcing him and is caught by the butler who was supposedly castrated by the Nazis. And it's just, it's a half page.
It could happen to anybody.
It's nothing.
So a half page anecdote in the life of William Burroughs. That's William Burroughs by Barry Miles, the second choice of Alex Starrett, arts editor of Newsweek. Thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks to our special guests earlier, Daniela Pellard and Robert Fox. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Max Koshik and Kate Bullivant. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Up after The Urbanist and up after the headlines, rather. I see him reading this out far too fast. Up after the headlines, The Urbanist with Andrew Tucker. 2200 Hours, The Monocle Daily. I'll be back for that with Peter Cardwell. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.